Hello. Welcome to another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking, the podcast series by the Young Lockwood Sauer team at UBS in Houston. I'm your host, Liz DeMontron, one of the financial advisors on the team. For compliance purposes, our team's phone number is 713-940-2872. As always, I'm very happy to be here today, and I am joined by my teammate and fellow financial advisor, Charles Litton. Welcome to the studio, Charles.
Thank you for having me, Liz. I'm looking forward to being here.
Yeah, it's been a while, so glad to have you back in the seat.
Glad to be back here.
Yes. Well, Charles and I are thrilled to welcome our guest today. Over the past 20 years, one of the areas of the market that has really exploded is private equity. And with this multitude of options for investing in private equity comes different approaches to investing in private businesses. And so today we welcome a group that seems to have a unique approach to investing, and they're also local to Houston, which is really our great fortune. So we're excited to welcome Fred Brazelton, CEO of Platform Partners. Welcome, Fred.
Yeah, Liz. Thanks, Charles. Thanks for having me. Look forward to the discussion.
Yeah, us too. Lots to talk about. Well, for disclosure purposes, I need to say that Fred is not affiliated with UBS. Now that we have that out of the way, I think we can dive into the conversation. So just to get us started, would you mind telling us more about your background, what led you to Platform, and more about the firm?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a native Houstonian, born and raised in Houston, went to the University of Texas for undergrad, and then spent a number of years away from Houston. Started my career in investment banking with what was then First Boston, now Credit Suisse. Worked for a couple different private equity firms, one of which was Hicks Muse in Dallas. Did my MBA at Stanford Business School, and then moved back to Houston a little over 20 years ago and started my career in Houston with a firm called the Cap Street Group, which is a traditional institutional private equity firm here in Houston. But background on Platform was in 2006, I have two partners, Fred Lummis and Brad Morgan, and we all worked at the Cap Street Group together, and we left the Cap Street Group to found Platform Partners with what we thought was a little bit of a unique strategy and business model, which was to invest out of a perpetual fund, and we can talk more about what that means later, but really to back these entrepreneurial and family-owned businesses with a long-term patient capital model. And so that's what we try to do. Most of the businesses we invest in are headquartered in Texas. They might have operations all over the country, but they're typically headquartered in Texas. And we invest anywhere from $20 million to $75 million of equity into these businesses. Most businesses are either entrepreneurially founded or family-owned businesses, and are looking for equity for a variety of purposes. But we're very much growth-oriented investors. We try to help these businesses figure out ways to grow their businesses. And they're typically missing some ingredient that we try to come in and help figure out what that is and solve that. So unlike a lot of private equity firms in Houston, we're very much generalists. So we actually focus, it's almost easier to describe what we don't do versus what we do do. With a few exceptions, we don't really invest in energy. We're not what I would call real estate investors. It's just basic businesses, proven business models. As we say, we're in the people business. We back people. And so that's a little bit about what we try to do.
Thanks for that, Fred. And incidentally, I remember starting my career almost 20 years ago now at Amegy Bank, and we were lenders to both Cap Street Group. And then when you and your team spun out of Cap Street, so to speak, in an amicable fashion, I remember y'all were sharing the same floor there in Chase Tower here in Houston. We were lenders to some of your first businesses, including Landmark. And so I had the opportunity to work on some of those deals. But I remember some of the discussion at the bank at that time, and that it was a novel concept, what you guys were doing, going out and starting this perpetual evergreen, if you will, pool of capital. Not a lot of conventional private equity firms would go to institutions like you suggested and take on capital commitments from them. And you guys were sort of starting up a new model. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why that makes y'all, how that's a competitive advantage and what have you?
Yeah, it's funny that you go back to that time. And we really made the structure up at the time. So this is back in 2006. And there weren't a whole lot of perpetual investment vehicles out there. And we were really fortunate, I think, to have a group of investors. And our investors are almost all either successful entrepreneurs or wealthy family offices, mostly around Texas. And so we were real fortunate to have those investors who were like-minded in terms of their investment objectives. They think in 10, 15, 20-year investment horizons. So that matched up with us. And they also trusted us a lot to commit part of their family's net worth to us in a perpetual investment model. And so we think that's a big advantage for us for a variety of reasons. And I can circle back to that. But like we say, I think our biggest asset is our investor base. And really the reason, just going back to the reason we did it that way, was what we found in the traditional private equity model, and there's nothing wrong with this, we just didn't want to do it this way, is, you know, if you're investing and you have kind of a 3 to 5 year investment horizon, you typically have to kind of make a lot of changes to a business within a very short period of time in order to realize the benefits of those changes within your investment horizon. And so what that looks like is usually a private equity firm will come in and within 12 or 18 months, they're making a lot of pretty significant changes to the business. And then within 3 years, they're really usually starting to think about how do we sell this? And so that's a treadmill that you get on that we felt like what's best for the business and what's best for the investment is to take a much longer term approach. We have a saying at Platform, act like you're going to own the business forever and make investments that way. We believe that builds a better business. And at some point, someone will recognize that value and you should be opportunistic about when that is. But
yeah, not so much dogmatic.
Not so much dogmatic.
You have to sell it 3, 5, 7 years down and realize money and return capital to your investors.
You know, and the other thing that people talk about the power of compounding in the public markets, but you don't hear talked about as much in the private markets. And so we believe that the same concept applies in the private markets. And so if you're a taxable investor, which our investors are, you really care about the after-tax proceeds. And we think that longer-term horizon really maximizes the dollar return versus the pre-tax IRR, which more institutional investors care about. The only other thing, this is totally selfish, is we just didn't want to run around the country raising money all the time.
Yeah, so it makes that part of your job a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Well, and I imagine to juxtapose perhaps the conventional seller to traditional private equity versus the people who are looking to sell to a group like Platform, is it a competitive advantage for y'all? Do you find yourselves, when you're talking to maybe contemporaries in the Houston market or regionally or across the nation, do you sometimes find yourselves getting different shots on goal than they may have? Or how does that play into the seller's kind of mentality, the perpetual nature of what you're doing?
Yeah, so we think that's a big advantage for us with some companies, not all companies, but with some companies. A lot of firms talk about how they're long-term, but I think we can say we went so far as to structure our company differently because we feel that strongly about it. And if you think about what we do, we're investing in the small to middle market companies, not the large companies. And we are almost always the first outside capital in a business. So these are families and entrepreneurs that maybe haven't gone through this process before. And so we believe kind of our patient approach, the fact that we're local, we always say we're the local white hat partner. We can walk those owners through this process a little bit better than a traditional private equity firm can. So again, if you're an owner, business owner, and you just want to sell your business for the highest price, 100% of your business for the highest price, maybe you don't care as much about some of those facets. But if you want to have a continuing role in the business post-transaction, we think that's important to some people. So
great. And you mentioned middle market, right? So you're not buying the billion-dollar businesses. Maybe for some of our listeners, if you could just briefly define middle market and then talk a little bit about what does the middle market landscape look like right now? You know, there's, as Liz alluded to, the private equity landscape has grown considerably over the past few decades, more and more dollars chasing ostensibly the same number of opportunities. So maybe if you could expand upon that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. And these terms all mean different things to different people.
Absolutely. Sure. So, how do you guys think about it on the platform?
So we're not venture capitalists. So we're not investing in startup companies or ideas. But I would say most of the businesses we invest in are anywhere from 25 to 50 million of revenue, all the way up to 250 million of revenue, kind of that size range. They're all already profitable. And like I mentioned, they're usually maybe missing some element to continue their growth. You know, we have a lot of respect for the entrepreneur who has gotten a business to that point, because that's a lot of times that's the hardest part is to get to that
point. And the riskiest.
Yeah, and the riskiest. But maybe they don't have the right team. Maybe they don't have the right capital structure. The other thing that's interesting to see is when you get to that point, every dollar of investment is a dollar out of that owner's pocket. And so if we can come in and reduce that risk a little bit for a business owner, what we found is they're more willing to invest in the business. They're more willing to take a little more risk because they don't own all the risk.
Yeah.
And so that's been a fun thing to watch in some of these businesses.
Sure. And how about, as an ex-lender, curious to hear, how's the lending environment for private equity right now? How are the banks looking at the deals that you guys are looking at in both a post-COVID world, as well as, you know, we've had a lot of machinations relative to higher interest rates, commercial real estate loans on these banks' balance sheets? Are any of those things affecting your business, or is it still business as usual? Maybe thoughts along those lines.
Yeah, so COVID was really interesting, and we have a diversified portfolio. We're invested in about 20 different businesses. So it was interesting to watch how COVID impacted some businesses actually very favorably, and some businesses had a lot of headwinds. We're starting to get to the other side of that. There is some what I would call post-COVID hangovers in some businesses that we're still working through. But really the biggest impact today I see is the interest rate environment. I mean, so you've got the good old days a couple years ago of almost 0% interest rates, which meant lending was very cheap and it was very plentiful. So today we see banks pulling back, you know, on the amount they're willing to lend, and it's more costly. And so that has led to probably a little bit of an impasse in the market, because that makes expected returns lower,
right,
unless you can reduce the price, and sellers haven't been willing to reduce the price so far. We're starting to see the equilibrium kind of start to come together. I mean, I think people are adjusting to that environment a little bit now.
The bid-ask spread is narrowing, kind of coming down, contracting a little bit. Okay.
I mean, the other thing is, and this doesn't impact platform as much as other private equity firms, but the private equity fundraising market was really depressed the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And institutions had what we call the denominator problem, which is their stock market was down up until last year. And then they had a heavy concentration to private equity, particularly venture capital, I think was challenging given the run up. And anyway, fundraising was really depressed the last couple of years. We're starting to see that come back as well. And so, as you guys know, the market will take breaks, and then at some point it starts to work again, you know, and we're seeing that right now in the private markets.
You mentioned that right now y'all own or invested in around 20 businesses. It sounds like most of those are in Houston, or most of them are in the state. How do you source your investments? Do you lean on a referral, like a large system, just a network of relationships? Are you doing cold outreach to private business owners? Would love to hear how you're sourcing some of those investments.
Sure. Yeah. So we really say our broadly defined, our network is where we get our best deals. We look at all of our deal flow coming in and then the investments we make, and it's about a 2% hit rate. So we're in a real low hit rate business, which can be frustrating, but it's just the way it is. But really, I mentioned our investors. Our investors send us a lot of deal flow. They're all active in the Houston business community, and maybe they see opportunities that they don't have the time or the resources to really pursue. That's a great source of deal flow. I bet probably a third of our portfolio has been sourced through referrals from other CEOs of our portfolio. And so we think that's a great testament to us working, how we work with these CEOs. And if you're a CEO of a business and another CEO calls you and says, no, they're great partners, you know, that means something. So we really don't like to participate in auction processes. And it's not really the valuations or the price you pay in those processes. But what we found is you just don't have time to get to know the business very well. And we always say this is like a marriage, and it's hard to get out of, and it's really expensive to get out of. And so you got to get it right on the front end.
You got to have a strong courtship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So a lot of the businesses we invest in, we've been talking to for a year or more. And that gives the owners a chance to get to know us,
right.
Us a chance to get to know the owners. You know, we just think that works better.
Sure. So, and so perhaps then too, the owners of the businesses that you end up investing in, they're not waking up one day and saying, well, I absolutely need to sell this business. They're waking up one day and saying, maybe I could take on a partner.
Yep, that's right. A lot of times our biggest competition is to do nothing for the business owner. But it's interesting. I mean, we see all different types of situations, which is kind of what makes the business interesting and fun, is to try to figure out what is really driving these business owners. But I would say we see a lot of situations where maybe a business owner has started a business with another partner. And, you know, you're 5 or 10 years into that, and the other partner is really a silent partner that's not active in the business. And we come in and we'll buy out that other partner. That's a situation we see a lot. Sometimes it's to finance acquisitions that the company has on tap. And sometimes it's legacy planning and liquidity for the owner. And so it's really a combination of different situations. The other thing about platform is, and there are other firms that do this as well, we'll invest in kind of control positions or over 50% ownership, but we'll also invest in minority positions, 30, 40% of a business, kind of depending on what the situation needs. So
when you take a more of a minority stake, then you're clearly not controlling the business, but you're maybe taking a few seats on the board and helping find a new CFO or things along those lines, being a value add in a different way than just taking complete control of the business.
Yeah, and we really don't see those situations as us acting any differently. Whether we own 30% or 70%, we kind of do the same thing in partnership with these business owners. And so, particularly with these size businesses, they're so reliant on that founder. And so the other situation we see is maybe the founder or the patriarch has been running the business and doing it very well, but it's gotten to the point where it's gotten bigger and they're just not having as much fun because they spend all their time thinking about the infrastructure and dealing with people problems.
Uh-huh. It's a different business than it used to be.
You're right. And we can come in and I think help put in the infrastructure to where that founder or CEO can get back to what he or she really likes doing, which is often growing the business and thinking about those things as opposed to maybe the minutiae of running the business. So
leave that to you guys.
So, yeah. So
when you do encounter a business owner who's thinking about a partial sale or a full sale, what's a short list of best practices in terms of due diligence, who to be hiring internally or externally? What's your advice?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I think the first thing to do is to get your financial house in order. And you'll go through a little bit of a proctology exam in this process. And so I would encourage business owners to think about getting ahead of that, maybe even bringing in a firm to do a Q of E or quality of earnings assessment on their business to see if there's any warts or issues in the financials. And that way you have time to address that before you start talking to a potential partner. Second thing I would say is to really put together your strategic plan or growth plan down on a piece of paper. We see a lot of situations where the CEO knows so much about the business, but it's all in their head. And really, new investors want to be able to assess a growth plan and react to that and have confidence in that. And we just see that that helps facilitate a better discussion if you can get that down on a piece of paper. And then the third thing I would say is to really write down your goals for the transaction ahead of time. We see a lot of situations where business owners, again, particularly if you're not going to sell the whole business, where they have a set of priorities going into the transaction, and then you get into the heat of the transaction and then they end up taking the highest dollar valuation, and then they've maybe forgotten some of the other goals they've had. And so having that discipline to stick to those original goals, I think, is helpful, because it can be a very emotional, challenging situation when you get to the goal line in these transactions. You see a lot of emotions come out.
A roadmap for investors like yourselves to understand how can we generate more value in this business, and then a roadmap for yourself and what you want, a checklist, so to speak, that says, hey, I don't just want the highest dollar amount, but maybe I want, whether it's control or involvement or divestment of a certain responsibility, like you alluded to earlier, just prioritizing things for yourself as well.
Right. And sticking to that. I think hiring a good advisor is really important. That could be, depending on the size of the business and what type of transaction you want to do, it could be an investment banker. There are a few lawyers in town who I think really specialize in these types of transactions that provide good advice. But having another trusted advisor or consigliere around the table is, I think, helpful.
Sure. So, switching gears for a second, you mentioned, you know, venture capital a few minutes ago, and obviously that's been topsy-turvy. Interest rates have even driven some of that, right? Those are long-tailed investments, and so rising interest rates and the drying up of free money has certainly crimped some of the demand for that, as well as some of the opportunity for them to find cheap money and keep on investing. That said, there are a lot of investments that have been made in the technology space. AI particularly has become front of mind for whether you're a public or private markets investor. And I know you guys are typically more involved in kind of the nuts and bolts businesses of the world, but imagine that AI is at least starting to hit the radar of some of these businesses. Just curious how you guys are seeing that from a, whether it's looking at other opportunities for investment in new businesses or implementing AI in your existing businesses. Any thoughts there?
AI is top of mind for everybody right now, investors, operators. Our perspective right now is the discussion is a little bit frothy. For most businesses, the business case or the use case for AI isn't quite there yet. I think in 2, 3, 4 years, you're really going to start to see these use cases come out and change certain business models a lot, but we're not there yet. So our plan is to be a fast follower and just kind of wait and see some of the technologies and use cases that come out. We have a couple of software businesses where we're dabbling in it a little bit. I definitely think it makes sense to start getting smarter about it and thinking about it. But I'd be a little hesitant, unless you're Google or Microsoft, in terms of rushing in and spending a lot of capital.
First mover disadvantage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
So that's our philosophy. We just hired a person internally at Platform that heads our technology, and he lives in Austin, and he's right in the middle of all the Austin technology scene.
Sure, yeah.
And even he thinks we're a little ahead of ourselves right now.
Right, right. So, yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up, I think we wanted to end with some fun questions. So as someone who sits in a seat where you're seeing lots of different types of companies, probably meeting lots of founders, I was curious as to who your favorite judge was on Shark Tank. And I hope your answer has not changed from our prep call.
Yeah, it's probably Mr. Wonderful.
Yeah,
like him. I like watching him. It's not the way we act, but I like watching him. So yeah,
you can live vicariously.
Yeah, totally.
Right. Yeah. Like my kids, when they watch Shark Tank, they're like, "Dad, is that what you do?" And I'm like, "Not at all." Anyway, so
I don't collect watches and invest in wine.
Yeah,
and
quite the opposite,
yeah.
Right?
We're not. I wish I was that
cool. We're not betting on the come.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, another question that's maybe more of a possibility, if you will, would be Houston, Texas, obviously a big market. You guys fish in this pond, not exclusively, but often. A lot of great businesses in this town. Any business in particular that when you look at it, if you had the resources to go out and buy it, that you would say, hey, that'd be an incredible business, whether it's just would be fun to run it, or you think perhaps there's ways to add value, or you see a long growth trajectory for that business? Anything that catches your eye?
So it's funny, I mentioned my kids, who I still don't think they really know what I do for a living, but they would say the best businesses they know of that we've invested in, at least, are the two spirits businesses. We invested in TX Whiskey and Pantalones Tequila. So they understand that. But those are actually tough businesses, so I'm not sure that would be my answer. So we are fortunate, I think, in that we get to look at a ton of different business models and companies as a generalist investor. And the single best business model I've ever seen is cellular towers. And it's just incredibly high margin, long-term contracts, people, you know. So the Houston-based business that I look at that, you know, is one of the dominant cellular tower companies is Crown Castle. They also built their headquarters right across from my house on I-10. So I think that'd be pretty cool to walk out, get the paper in the morning and see your own building and own that business. So that would be my answer. So
that's great.
Well, okay, last question. Any Sweet 16 predictions? Any March Madness thoughts?
Oh, man. I have U of H winning it all, and I almost lost it against the Aggies. So I was glad to see them win, but I'm going to stick with the Cougars. So hoping Phi Slamma Jamma can kind of make its way back.
Sure. So. What a great way to end. The hometown pick from the hometown private equity firm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Fred. It's been such a pleasure. I've learned a ton more about what you guys are doing, you know, the middle market investing landscape, and excited to see all that is to come.
Thanks so much, Fred. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
This is your host, Liz DeMontron, signing off. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.